I apologize because obviously there's so many things that we did not get to cover. For an optional summer session tonight, I don't want to take away your business money. But I feel like the Kayin Gadol, I wasn't serious, not the Kayin Gadol on Yom Kippur. So if you remember, he reads from the Sefer Torah Acharei Mais, and then he's Gailel to a shtickle in Parshas Emor. But Parshas Pinchas, which also has about the Musafin of Yom Kippur, he's Kairei Al Peh, because it would be a Tirchei Tzibura to be Gailel all the way to Pinchas, and you're not, might see a second Sefer Torah when there's only one Ayla, because that's a pagam to the first Sefer Torah. So he prefaced his statement with Yaiser Mimasha Karasi Lefnechem Kasuv Khan. There's a lot more that more than I've said, and that's certainly what we're going to say here. But so I'm going to try to do what I can, but obviously there'll be a lot that's going to be chaser. But again, you can go on and learn and be Mayan and think about these different minyanim. I just want to mention, I can't not mention the Vardik. I mentioned that the sheet of Kelim, and the sight of Kelim was the notion of Seder, discipline, mastery, Shlita. Slobodka, again, I'm obviously oversimplifying. Slobodka was individuality, creativity, godless Adam, and the Alter's Shita was that when a person recognizes his godless, he's not going to be chayte, because how could you take such a gavaldiga, important chashuv thing and make it filthy? So what was Navardik? So first, Navardik was Rav Yosef Yisrael Horowitz. And Rav Yosef Yisrael Horowitz also was not a Talmud of Rav Yisrael. He was also a Talmud of Rav Simcha Zissel. But he met Rav Yisrael once, just like the Alter met Rav Yisrael once, and Alter Slobodka. And the story goes that the Alter of Navardik, Rav Yosef Yisrael, was a Yosem, and he was supporting his family at a young age. And he was a very good businessman. Actually, he was quite successful in his business, even as a 15 or 16 year old, an entrepreneur. And he meets Rabbi Yisrael, and Rabbi Yisrael says to him, "So what does the Yid do? What's Tzitzit Yid?" So he says, "Well, I work, and I eat him l'tayra." He says, "A Yid has to make a living." So Rabbi Yisrael said to him one line, he says, "A Yid has to live, but a Yid also has to prepare for dying, that when he dies, what does he bring to Olam Haba?" So apparently, this had a deep enough hashpa on Rabbi Yisrael, on the altar, that the story goes, he was mafker his wagon. He stopped his business in the middle of the day. He was mafker his wagon, whatever it is. He got some apitrophis to take care of the family. And he became a person who was learning full-time, Leishik and Musser. At some point in his life, now this is probably after he got married and he became a widower, so he was not... he actually took off 2 years in the Vardik, and he locked himself in the house. Actually, locked himself is really, I mean quite literally, meaning he bricked himself into a house. In other words, the door was bricked. He could not leave if he wanted to. There were two holes in the wall, one for Milchig, one for Fleisch, because he wouldn't even know what food people were giving him. People would give him food, and he was called Rabbi Yisrael Baal HaChayrim, Rabbi Yisrael of the holes, because for 2 years, he was just sitting by himself, locked in a house that he couldn't get out of even if he wanted to. The house would have to be destroyed to get him out, to be misbaided, to be by himself, to think about Avodas Hashem, to focus on Aliyah. And many Yidden in the Vardik thought this man was crazy, and they demanded that the house be destroyed. The guys of Meshuggah, the Rav of the Vardik, of course, at the time was the Aruch HaShulchan. It was considered to be the Gadol of the Paiskim. And although the Aruch HaShulchan Bechlau was not necessarily connected to a Shita of Musar in particular, although he was a great, great tzaddik, but he said, Rabbi Yisrael is a tzaddik, leave him alone, this is his derech. He says, "I don't understand it, it doesn't make sense to me," but he has a cheshbon. Anyway, after 2 years, the house was dismantled. That's machlekes. Did he decide or the landlord decided that, hey, you gotta get, might as well get a tenant or sell the house or something? He went on. Apparently, 2 years of isolation, you can build up a lot of energy. And he literally established 120 yeshivas throughout the breadth of Poland and Russia. The Stipler, for example, was a Talmud of Rabbi Yisrael. The Stipler was Rosh Hashiva in the Vardik. I mean, that was the Stipler's only stellar. Once the Stipler came to Eretz Yisrael, for a little bit he was Rosh Hashiva in the Vardik here, but most of his life he did not have an official position. The Chazon Ish always called the Stipler the Rosh Hashiva. based on his experience in Nevardik. Rav Chaim Shmulevitz, by the way, is the Einikel of the Elder of Nevardik. Rav Rafael Shmulevitz, Rav Chaim's father, was a son-in-law of the Elder of Nevardik. Rav Ram Yafin was the other son-in-law of the Elder of Nevardik. Rav Ram Yafin became the Rosh Hashiva of Nevardik. Rav Ram Yafin was Rav Chaim Shmulevitz's uncle. And most of you, I think, have heard of Rav Ram Yafin. One of his sons, if you ever look at the Ritvan Yevamis, you ever see the Ritvan Yevamis? Ritvan Yevamis is basically an excuse for Rav Yafin to write a sefer on Yevamis and not have to pay for the printing. Because there's like a little bit of a Ritva, and then it's Gavaldik. You know, these are not just Mara Machaimus, these are Chidushim and Marachas. You know, that's why it's two fat volumes. But it's done as Hagos on the Ritva. You know, most Hagos are just like, you know, Mara Machaimus or something. So this is a good way. If you ever feel that you want to write the Sefer, but you don't have the money, so try to become a Magia for a Rishon or something, and then they'll pay you, and you'll get to publish your Kiddushah. But most of Rav Kook was very tolerant, but on the other hand, I have to say too that the Kiddushim are very, 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 very high quality. It's in fact very, very worthy to be published even with the Ritva. But okay, but be it as it may, they tell a famous story that Rav Chaim Shmulevitz used to visit his uncle, Rav Ram Yafin, in the Vardik. And this is when he was a single boy, when he was just a bachur. And he would ask Rav Ram Yafin, like kids like to ask, who's the best guy in the yeshiva? I mean, you don't really ask Rav Yeshiva that, who's the best guy? So Rav Ram Yafin said, they're all good. He said, no, but who's the real best? So he started saying, well, this person is the biggest masmid, and this person is the biggest bal tefila, and this person is the biggest bal chesed, and this person is the biggest baki, and this person is the biggest charif. So Rav Chaim Shlomo said, but who's the best of the best? Tell me the best of the best. So he pointed to another bacher who was the stipler. But the stipler did not make the list of any of the top and any of the other qualities. Rav Chaim asked his uncle, he says, how is it you're talking? This person is not the best in this category, and not the best in this category, not the best in this category, so why is he the best of the best? So Rav Ram Yafin said, because he's the greatest mavakesh. He's the greatest person who is mavakesh aliyah. And if one is a mavakesh aliyah, then everything will come. So even if he's not, let's say right now, the smartest, he doesn't know the most, whatever it would be, but he is the greatest one that's mavakesh aliyah. So what was the overall, again, I'm trying to give you a one-line summary, because I think one line, just as a yesod, is helpful. In Kelim, the yesod hadvarim was seder, mastery, shlita, discipline, not to give in to your feelings, self-control in a positive way, including Sefer Panim Yafa. Self-control would not be with tension and netzach, but it would be, you know, with Sefer Panim Yafa. But it's shalita. Slabatka, an awareness of your godless. In Nevardik, it was actually emuna. Now, obviously, Kelim Slabatka taught emuna as well. But in Nevardik, the concept was to, number one, not be afraid of anything. Havi'oz Kenomer, Pirkei Avos says, and Chazal interpret that to mean, the Ramah brings it in the beginning of the Shulchan Aruch, not to be embarrassed or humiliated in your Avodas Hashem. You do what you need to do, no matter what people think of you, even if you think you're crazy, even if they think it's stupid. Don't be afraid. Don't be afraid of psychological insults, and don't even be afraid of sakana, mamish. That's why they say that the Alter of the Vardik had a cheshbon, that he would sometimes make Talmidim do things that made them look stupid, to be margil them in not being embarrassed. So for example, they would go into a grocery store and they would ask for nails. They would go into a hardware store and they would ask for milk. And the chenveni, you know, says, well, what are you crazy? What are you walking into a makolet and you're asking for nails? But that's to be margul a person. Don't be mavoish. Now, obviously this is controversial, because one could argue for keres. In Kelim, the shita would be, you're acting like a meshugana? That's chilul Hashem. A ben Torah has to be dignified. Right? So, this is one of the tiniest on the Vardik, that the relational Horowitz's idea was that sometimes the mahus of dignity means we don't do things that we think are not lefi chavadeinu, even though it needs to be done. He wanted to break the mida that I'm chas on my kavod. controversial because there are halachas of Kiddush Hashem and Chilul Hashem, but this is the story. And because of this, his Talmidim were fearless, as he was. He was fearless because during the years, remember that most of the yeshivas, Slobodka, Mir, they were not located in Russia. They were located in Poland. Now it happened to be that that part of Poland was generally under the Tsar. But after the Russian Revolution, when Poland became independent, the yeshivas were not in Russia. The yeshivas were in Poland. But many of the Novartika yeshivas were actually in Stalinist Russia. And one has to remember that as bad as the Tsar was, Lenin and Stalin were a lot worse, because except for Volozhin, Volozhin was closed down, but generally speaking, you know, Tsarist Russia, there were yeshivas. They let Jews do what they want. They oppressed them, they taxed them, but they didn't send you to Siberia for learning Torah. You can learn Torah, but they harassed you in many, many ways. With Lenin, and then Stalin for sure, it became a whole different ballgame. Stalin wanted to be mashkes, the concept of God, from the consciousness of Russia. The Tsar was not. The Tsar had his own mishas, had his own mishugas, but Yidden could learn Torah. Bianias, bedachkas, etc., but they learned Torah. But Stalin mamish wanted to be mashkes. Not kidei kach, that Stalin actually wanted to abolish the seventh day, right? In every society, people rest on the seventh day, whether it's Shabbos or Sunday. You know, there's a day off every seventh. He wanted to be oiker, the notion of a seventh day. So he wanted to create a work week that was 9 days with a tenth day off, so people should have no shaychus to the musik of Shabbos.
That speaks about the change of the calendar.
Yeah, that's correct. That's correct. And Stalin was not able to do that. The union of Shabbos, even if it's the wrong day, was deeply mutba in even the souls of Goyim and the like. So the MS is for 70 years in the former Soviet Union. Now Baruch Hashem is not there, although you know Russia itself was pretty bad. And now, for 70 years, it was mamashe sakana to teach Torah. People went to Siberia. There were some synagogues in Moscow. They allowed Sakanim to go, old people. But they had KGB or NKVD, different names. Secret police went by different names. Sometimes it was the Cheka, then it was the NKVD, and then it was the KGB, which it still is. Putin, president of Russia, he started his career with many years of distinction as the head of the KGB and the like. And they would watch. They would watch the show. So if a young guy came in, big sakana, big sakana for the show, big sakana for the zakenim, big sakana for the young people. There was only one time that they allowed the public celebration of religion for some reason. It's similar to the Romans who allowed the Yidden to come to Yerushalayim to celebrate or commemorate Tisha B'Av. They allowed them to have hakavas on Simchas Torah. So if you ever looked at pictures from the 1960s, or earlier, you see like tens of thousands of Russian Jews who knew nothing at all. They knew nothing at all. But they would come and they would dance on Simchas Torah. In fact, there's a very famous picture. This either moves you or not, depending on your orientation. Golda Meir was the first ambassador of the new state of Israel to the Soviet Union. Because for some reason, the Soviet Union recognized Israel. In fact, they recognized Israel. Stalin must have had some nefarious touch with
it.
Yes, yes. But they recognized the state of Israel before the United States. Truman did it like 20 minutes after the state was announced, and Stalin did it 10 minutes. It's not clear. Stalin for certainly had a nefarious cheshbon, but whatever his cheshbon was. So Golda Meir, they have a picture of Golda Meir, who probably did not keep Simchas Torah in Eretz Yisrael, or even Milwaukee, where she came from. But here she comes to the synagogue of Simchas Torah, and there are like hundreds of thousands of Russians that are dancing around and glorifying. So Stalin gave them one day a year, but Torah itself, mamishnat. And you have to know that the Russians were so meticulous over this. They would have KGB informers in every base Knesset, every little yeshiva where old people might be learning, and the like. And what's amazing is the amount of resources that Stalin devoted to this. I mean, Stalin would train a KGB guy by maybe sending him to yeshiva for 10 years so he would know when Jews are talking and learning, you know what they're talking about. So you had guys who had smicha. Maybe they were Jews, maybe they weren't. Who would come in and the like. So for those 70 years, there was only a few isolated pockets that kept Torah going. One was Chabad, and one cannot deny that Chabad was doing teaching and Kirov in the middle of Stalinist Russia. The mainstream yeshivas were not there, Baruch Hashem, they were in Poland. The other, which was much smaller, was Breslov. Breslov was doing. And the third Zerim was Nevardik. Nevardik was able, because they weren't scared. They were not scared. They said, let it be B'sakana. Now, the emes is, in the Chazon Ish's Sefer, Emunah U'Bitachon, beautiful, beautiful Sefer. It was a censored Sefer also. It was a censored Sefer, meaning they took out a number of pages. I'm not sure if they put it back in or didn't put it back in.
They?
Huh? They, the family, when they found the Grineman family, the Chazon Ish's brother, when they printed the Emunah U'Bitachon after the Chazon Ish's Petira, they decided to take out, it was after World War II, they took out a number of things, although you could infer the Chazon Ish Yeshiva from what is in there. And the Chazon Ish articulates the idea that a Yid has to be machlit according to halacha, because again, and really, he was criticizing Nevardik. He doesn't mention Nevardik by name, but he was criticizing the shitas of Musar that say your emunah has to be so muchlit that you have to put yourself, the Alter Nevardik basically said, you put yourself b'makam sakana. And if you're maimon that Hashem will take you out of sakana, no matter what the sakana is, you will be answered. And that is how they were marvitz tayre v'shas sakana and everything else. And the Alter Nevardik said, emunah has to be muchlit, even to be samech hanisim. And the Chazon Ish has a whole arichas, and even some of it is even in the part that wasn't censored, in which the Chazon Ish says that religious fervor, religious feeling, religious inspiration has to be miyusid on the yisaitis of halacha. There is no such thing as stam a regesh that's divorced from the halacha. If the halacha says en saimchen al anes, then you're not allowed to be a tzaddik and say I'm going to be saimchen anes. If the halacha says that the mitzvah is supposed to be in a certain way, that a Talmud Chacham has to act l'fi chavaydei b'derech kavod, you're not allowed to make a cheshbon that since I have to be mevatel the midah of gaiva, I can make myself a shlump, whatever it would be. And the emes is, the Chazon Ish was addressing what he thought was certain kilkulim in the Vardik Befrat. It was taken out because after the Milchama, the Eilam HaTayr was so small, they thought it wasn't kedai to be mafarsing hisnagdus. And of course, keep in mind, the Chazon Ish, in spite of the Chazon Ish's hisnagdus to Nevardik, the man that he chose to be the husband of his wife, to be, I'm sorry, husband of his sister, I'm sorry, was of course the Stipler, who was the Rashiv of Nevardik. You know. But to this day, you see that, number one, Nevardikers are very much not into chitzanius. Unlike Slobodka, you know, you have to dress nicely, dress fancy. But you see, the Stipler Kanevskis, they're not into chitzanius, etc. That means like nothing to them. That is really a Yerusha from the altar of Nevardik. There was no contra of Chaim constantly, you know, he learns with his shirt without, you know, an altar, you know, a kelimer or a Slobodka, you know, you have to learn, you know, b'derech kavod, you have to wear your frock, etc. By the Nevardikers, the chitzanius had nothing at all, and even the kanois a little bit, in which you're willing to call a spade, you're not that diplomatic, you. No, you're stark when you have to be stark. That's the Yerusha of the Nevardik. So the Stipler is very much had the Yerusha of Nevardik. So this is so again, to summarize and just sound bites, it's a disservice to do a sound bite. Kelum was Seder and Shlita, Slobodka was godless Adam, and Nevardik was fearlessness and Emuna, in which you don't get scared. Nothing gets scared. And because of this, the altar said, you never ask yourself, is it shayach to do something? You only ask yourself if it should be done. If it's a good thing to do, you start doing it. You don't make a cheshbon, is it shayach, is it not shayach? So they tell a story, one of the altar's talmidim, Rav Gershon Liebman, was a reshiva of Nevardik yeshivas in France. And he used to come to collect money. So two things. So one might say is he once came to Kennedy. He would not take money with him. He would not take money with him because he said, "I'm a shaliach mitzvah. The Eivishter will help me. I don't have to take any money." So imagine he comes to the United States. He does not have a cent, a penny, or whatever the French money is. He doesn't have it in his pocket. A friend. He has nothing. So he gets to the airport. One of his talmidim happened to be in the airport. So he sees the Rosh Yeshiva and he says, oh, could I offer the Rosh Yeshiva a ride? All right, so yeah, Baruch Hashem. So he's giving the Rosh Yeshiva a ride. So in the middle, he kind of coughs, the Talmud coughs, you know, Rebbe, forgive me for asking, but I'm just wondering, you know, what would have happened if I wouldn't have been here? He says, what's your question? You're here, aren't you? He says, it would either be you or somebody else. He says, what's the shayla? That's bitachon, that's emuna. Now, Rav Libman had another problem. Rav Libman had to collect money, but Rav Libman was, he got physically ill when he saw money. He hated money. He vomited when he got money. He started retching. He could not be soivel. He could not be soivel the gashmias of money. So there was. So he always had to collect with another guy who would physically. He could not physically take money. Now they tell a story just about the Alter of Novartik. One other story. They tell the story that he once went to collect from somebody, from a gevir who was known to be a very selfish person. And he got a lot of money from the gevir. So another Rosh Yeshiva asked him, he says, I don't know what your secret is. I've been going after this guy for so many years, and he gives me nothing. He gives me a little bit. And you, Baruch Hashem, you get so much. How does that happen? So the altar said the following. I'll tell you the story. You walk into his house, and you see fancy carpets and furniture, and you have so much derech eretz, so much yiras hakavod. You wipe your feet, you dust off your coat, you don't put your hands on the table because maybe there'll be a fingerprint. So you show the person your machshiv is wealth. You show the person that money and the chasim is a double chashiv. You then ask him to give it up. He's not going to give it up. You just told him how chashiv it is. You're asking him to give up something very important. I come in, he said, and you know, I track mud into the house, he says. I put my feet on the chair. I communicate, now I'm not sure if the halacha is. He says, I communicate to the person, you have nothing. Your wealth is garnished. Your economic prosperity is worthless. But I'm going to do you a favor. I'm going to give you a way where you can invest your money in Hachzakas Torah, and then it becomes chashiv. So when I ask a guy for money, I'm not asking him to give. I'm doing him a taiva. Ah, so if you're doing a taiva, so a person will want to have a good return on his investment. Now, lahalacha, whether the Alter of Nevada tracked mud into somebody's house, you know, you have a chayshin mishpat shayla there, and it's not at all pashut. It's like they tell a story about the Gra, which Reb Chaim Kineski said is absolutely false, but it's a story that is recorded. Reb Chaim Kineski said it's not yitachin bichlal. But they tell the story about a man came to the Gra Shabbos afternoon for a bracha. And he was wearing a litvish shtreimel. You know, he was a shtreimel in Europe. Misnagdim more shtreimel chalsam. And it says the Gra gave him a bracha by putting his fingers on the shtreimel, but the Gra's fingers had some cholent on them. So as a result, there were like fingerprints on the shtreimel. And the Maisa goes that the person never cleaned the shtreimel for the next 50 years because he wanted to have the fingerprints of the Gra on the shtreimel. So Reb Chaim Kineski said, he says, Ze lo yitochen klal uklal. Number one, in Hilchas Cheshen Mishpat, it's not shayach that the Gra would allow somebody's beged to be, you know, dirtied by his fingers. And number two, he says, the notion that the Gra would have cholent on his fingers also is lo yitochen. So he said it's lo yitochen. So by the Alter of Nevardik, I'm not sure. Maybe it is yitochen. The Alter of Nevardik was an extreme person. But still, that's part of the Chazanish's critique. The Chazanish would basically say, yeah, you have a gevaldige cheshbon. But if there's a din in cheshbon mishpat, you don't make somebody's property dirty, you know, how is he talking? But this was the sheet of Navardik. It was a kitsainius. Now the emes is, Baruch Hashem, they're still in Navardik today, but the truth of the matter is, everything is diluted and mixed. Meaning you walked into Navardik today, it's not going to be, I mean, it's small, but smaller than Mir, but intrinsically, it is not much different than Mir, except one-tenth the size, or whatever it is. So, you know, Slobodka, Chevron is not truly Slobodka, although the godless Adam they still have sometimes Al-Sat HaGaiba. Okay, that's a chisorium. Kelim is not really there. The Kelim sheet is pashut not there that much. Revolba was Kemat, the last person of Kelim Musar. And Nevardik also is in terms of the Slavos and the Mesiris Nefesh of Nevardik, it's something that is lacking. Meaning to say, we have Mizugim, we have mixtures of all sorts of things, but these are three distinct Mahalchim, and all of them are Yainik, actually all from Rav Simcha Zissel, but indirectly from Rabbi Yisrael. Yeah.
The typical description that Nevardik was the opposite of Slobodka, that they're different and garnished.
Yes.
Accurate?
Well, it is accurate. It is accurate, but in the sense that it wasn't so much to make you feel bad about yourself, but it was to empower you. The Alter Shita was that when a mensch doesn't have his ego in the way, he is not afraid of failing. Now, there's a lot of times in life, generally, we don't want to do something. If I can't do it, gewaldig. If I can't give a, they have to give a chibur over here. And, you know, it's not going to be gewaldic. So I don't want to do it because people will think I'm not the greatest person. So a lot of times a person's gaiva, a person's ego, is maneya him from doing what HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants him to do. So the Alter Shita was, be mevatel your ego, and then you become a person who is powerful enough to do whatever needs to be done, because you're not afraid of failing. Even if you crash, even if you fail, even if you mess up, but you were doing the Rasun Hashem at that moment, therefore there's nothing to be ashamed of. So in that sense, Ich bin a garnished was an important thing. But as they say, and that requires sometimes doing things, this is what the Chazon Ish said, that are connected the Inyanim of Hanhagas Talmid Chacham and Hilchos Deos, right? The Rambam writes, based on the Gemara, that a Talmud Chacham has to behave in a mechubedik way, you know, etc. And the Vardik was kind of the opposite. Be mevazi yourself, and that way you're not embarrassed to do what you need to do. Very, very interesting shita, which, as I say, is kind of extinct today. And, you know, maybe there are good reasons, because so many of you are not from, so if a person is misnahig in a bizarre way, a little bit, that's going to turn people off. But still, it's a hasaga to keep in mind that it's often the ego. That's what Hasidus talked about it also. Hasidus talked about bitul hayesh. Bitul hayesh. A person has to be mevatel, their sense of yeshus, their sense of ego, which is kind of almost the opposite of godless adam of Slobodka, right? That's the kind of the opposite mahalach. Yeah. Yeah, I think more in Hasidus maybe, and I don't know if they're following in the Vardiker Mahalach, but yeah, there are tzaddikim that have their own cheshbainis. Listen, this is an interesting philosophical question. I mean, some would call it kfira, but some would say there's such a thing, and that is it shayach for a, let me put it in a gross way, is it shayach for a yochid to make a private deal with HaKadosh Baruch Hu? Meaning, on one hand, we say the Torah is nitzchi, right? The Torah is nitzchias. But the Torah was given to Klal Yisrael. Now, obviously, for any one person to say, I'm putter from mitzvahs, of course there's no such thing. But what tzaddikim can do, private, you know, protexia, private arrangements, is there such a musig? Again, it's a dangerous musig. I mean, I've heard people who are totally porke ol say, I have a private relationship with God, he understands me. Yeah, okay, that you can't say. But what tzaddikim could say, you know, who knows? I mean, this is the only problem is that when these private cheshbainis of people who are infinitely above us become the public anhagos of followers, then it becomes a very destructive idea. In fact, the emes is the Nitziv says that this was really the cheshbain of Dasan v'Aviram. I'm sorry, not of an Avil, not of an Avil. That not of an Avil were such great tzaddikim that they held, they did not have to have the gedorim of the halacha. And the emesis and the tzif says, lefi madrei gasam, they were correct. Elamai, but they had to be killed because they couldn't be the manhigim of the am. They could not be the role models that we follow. Because it's not shayach for us to follow that hanhaga, but they had a miyuchadika hanhaga. Again, it's a controversial notion. Some would absolutely say such a thing is not shayach at all. Okay, I'm not going to be machlet, but I can say with great confidence it's not shayach to any of us. So for sure, it's whatever this is a madrega that's way beyond anything that we have any shaykhs to. So your point is a well taken point. One other thing, a few more horrors about the Musar again. It's good that, again, as I said, although in learning generally, you know, sound bites are to be discouraged. One should try to be mimic, but sometimes it's helpful to have like a yisoid by which you can understand something, and then you can look at the pratim and you can kind of coalesce it around your site. So I think it's good to have this one-liner for each of these shitas. One beautiful thing Rav Simcha Zissel said about Rav Yisrael, and I just want to stick it in because it is such a beautiful thing. It's such a yisoid in Kiruv. I actually mentioned it, Shivas Rav Thomas. Rav Simcha Zissel lived during the time when Darwin wrote his book on evolution. And people were debating, man comes from monkeys. In fact, there's a famous passage from Rav Shimshon Rafael Hirsch. Rav Shimshon Rafael Hirsch says, he says, he's not machlit, there's such a thing as evolution. He says he's not machlit, but he says, im timtza leimar, that we could prove 100% that there's evolution, he said it would not be a, Rav Hirsch writes, he would not be a stira to emuna, it would just be the hechi timtza through which HaKadosh Baruch Hu was Bayre the Island. So that's a very important little piece, which again I think contemporary Gedalia might not agree with. But he basically timed it that intrinsically evolution is not a stira to Hashgacha Pratis, and it's not a stira to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. HaKadosh Baruch Hu guides the press. Okay. But be it as it may, Rav Simcha Zissel was asked, evolution, what do you think? So this is what he said. He said, Darwin believed in evolution because he never met Rabbi Yisrael. So you meet an average person, right? Maybe he came from a monkey, you know, whatever. He says, if he would have met Rabbi Yisrael, he would have known only the Eibishter could have made such a person. And that, again, on the Estaiti, is a very interesting yisoid in Kiruv Rechaikim. Because what it indicates is that what really changes and influences a person is not so much the intellectual arguments and the proofs of God, but it's the hashpa of meeting a person of Kedusha, a person of godless, a person of the aura of Torah that shines through them. And at that point, even if I don't have the cheshbainus of how do I know the Torah is from God, I'm margish the Torah is from God because I see what the Torah does to such a person. Now, that may not be true for, you know, every Talmud Chacham necessarily. Unfortunately, I mean, you know, all of us should work for that. But if you meet a true gadol, there's a certain hashpa that you see from that gadol, that you just feel. You feel the shechina pashut. You feel. I remember when Rav Moshe used to visit when I was growing up. I absolutely remember as an 8 to 9 year old the light, hadras panim, the light coming from his face. I remember it. I remember it. You could absolutely see it.
That ma'aseh the Rebbe said on Shavuos of Thomas is amazing.
Isn't it a beautiful ma'aseh? Yeah, I didn't want to repeat it, but yeah. Yeah, great, great ma'aseh. And those are ma'aseh, by the way, that, you know, they make a bigger hashpa on a person than maybe all of the Torah you might hear from somebody, just to say, you know, Adam Gadol. So, this is what Rav Simcha Zissel said. Again, it's an important yisoid to remember. By the way, just one other point, just to give you an opportunity in Kelam and Slobodka, to go back to one Nikuda. That is, because Kelam was about discipline and structure, so Kelam Musar tended to be very, very straightforward. It was not pilpulistic. It was not, in other words, the altar of Kelam was not interested in being miyashev, a stira between Rabbeinu Yaina and the Kuzari. I'll give you some lumba shechiluk. He would simply say, we have gaiva, we have to be oiker the gaiva, and this is the practical way that you do it. Slobodka became a much more intellectualized type of lumdisha Musar. So, for example, if you look at the Sefer Pachad Yitzchak, right? Pachad Yitzchak, Rav Huttner. Pachad Yitzchak is a sefer about, as Rav Huttner says, Chayvas Halavavas, you know, the internal, emotional drachim of serving Hashem. But you see, it's like a lumdisha sefer. I mean, it's a lumdisha in a philosophical way. He's miyashiv stiras. He'll bring in a taisves and a ramban and a gra and a maral and try to, you know, fe'emfer and make chilukim. Because since Slobodka was primarily an emphasis on the intellect and the godless Adam, so even their approach to Musar was a very intellectualized, philosophical approach. in Kelim, they would basically say you're just being mafalpel because you don't want to do the avodah of cheshbon nefesh. I don't need to hear, you know, all sorts of chilukim in madregas of gaiva. If you got gaiva, you got to work on it, you know. So Kelim was very, very different in that in that mahalak. Let me mention two more personalities who did not found schools of Musar, but they were very important. And these were Talmidim. These were direct Talmidim of Rav Yisrael Salanter, just as Rav Simcha Zissel. One was Rav Yitzchak Blazer, who is known as Rav Yitzchak Petterberger, not to be confused with Rav Yitzchak Lepanovicher. That's a different person. He was the first Rosh Yeshiva of Slobodka, but Rav Yitzchak Petterberger, who was the Rav for a while in Petersburg, which was the Tsarist capital of Russia. Moscow was not. Right, St. Petersburg was the capital. And B'Saif Yamav, Rav Yitzchak Blazer, actually came to Eretz Israel. He lived in Yerushalayim. He was Nifter here in Yerushalayim. I think he's buried on Har HaZeisim. And the second person was Rav Naftali Amsterdam, who was not from Amsterdam, but Rav Naftali. Both of them, after Rav Yitzchak left Petersburg, and Rav Naftali Amsterdam was a Rav in all places in Helsinki, Finland. But both of them retired from Rabbanus. They didn't want Rabbanus, and they moved to Kovna, and they kind of hung around Slobodka. Rav Naftali Mamish is a private citizen. Petterberger gave Musar Shmuzim and Elul and the like. But they were really behind the scenes. They were not Magidei Shir, they were not Mashkichim, but they were great, great, great tzaddikim that had a tremendous hashpa. Shvidei Yesh writes, he was very close to Rav Yitzchak Petterberger and also Rav Naftali. Rav Naftali made his parnas as a baker. He used to bake bake rolls. But his thing was, he believed that every Ben Torah should have a Kviyas and Ketzais HaChayshet. So he always would have a Bacher from Slobodka that they would learn Ketzais every week. And he would never let a Bacher be Meshavet, although he was in his 70s, his 80s, he would get the Svarim. He would not allow anyone to be Meshamesh. Witzel Petterberger was more known. He was more Meforsen a little bit. Number one, he was a Rav of a very big city. He was a Mechaber of a Sefer of Shelos Tshuvas, Kri Yitzchak, which is a Chashev Sefer. But he had a very interesting Shita. For reasons of Anava, whenever Rabbanim would be speaking in Torah, he would never say anything. He would never say anything. He would just be quiet. He would just listen. So they have a Maisa, the Beis Halevi. You know, Petersburg, obviously many Rabbanim would come to Petersburg. They would talk to the Tsar's representatives. You know, they were always Asifas, because they're always Kazeris against Jews. So the Beis Halevi and many other Rabbanim came, and they were Makabel Panim of Rav Yitzchak. And the Beis Halevi, who said a Gevaldik, a Chiddush, and all the Rabbanim were Mefalpo, Mikan, and Mikan. They were slugging it up and bringing Rayas, and the Beis Halevi, it was Mamish Mulchamta Shel Torah. But the Petersburger Rav didn't say anything at all. He just nodded, he just listened. And the Beis Halevi had a lot of Agmas Nefesh. He said, and I say that the Rav of Petersburg, I mean, doesn't know how to learn what's going on. Anyway, he heard later that this Rav published the Sefer Pri Yitzchak. So he wanted to see what type of person. So he sees in the Pri Yitzchak that he asks the Beis Halevi's kasha. He gives the Beis Halevi's teretz. He shlugs it up with all sorts of rayas. And then he gives two terutzim of his own. So like everything that was said, he already did. But in his hanava, he did not want to say anything. So he was a tremendous, tremendous anav, a bal chesed, a bal regesh. When he would speak, unlike the Alter Slobodka, who tried to be unemotional. The Alter Slobodka had a very strange cheshbon. The Alter Slobodka felt that emotions were suspect. So he would speak in a monotone. And he bedavka didn't want to get people misragish. He wanted them to think, to come to Aveda through the Moach. That was the Alter of Slobodka. But Rav Yitzchak Petterberger was a Bal Regesh, and people would cry, people would sob, people, you know, he'd speak Yamim Narayim. He would sometimes stop in the middle of a shmooze, and they would sing a nigun in the middle of a shmooze, because to be Ma'irer, etc. Tremendous power. People talk about, now this is actually a little before Rav Yaakov, this is before Rav Yaakov Avraham, this is like the earlier years of Slobodka. And Rav Yitzchak was also the Mechaber of the Or Yisrael. So although he didn't have a lot of Talmidim, but he was the one that was mefarsem Rabbi Yisrael Shita Bichsav. The Or Yisrael has many parts. The first part of the Sefer Or Yisrael is called Sharei Or, in which it's a biography of Rabbi Yisrael, and many of the maisim that we know from Rabbi Yisrael are from that book. In other words, he knew Rabbi Yisrael very well. He had many years with him, and he recounted many, many maisim. The second are ksavim of Rabbi Yisrael himself. Rabbi Yisrael himself, his letters. Mainly these were letters, but he published the letters and the like. And the third is Rabbi Yitzchak's own chidushim al derech hamusar. In Avodas Hashem, he takes different Gemaras, takes from Amari Chazal. So Or Yisrael is a very, very important sefer. I mean, it's a very, very good sefer, even today, kedai to learn. And it was a very important sefer in being mefarsein Rabbi Yisrael's teachings to the Welt, especially since Rav Yitzchak was well regarded, because Rav Yitzchak was a mainstream, he just wasn't a mushinik, he was a mainstream Talmud Chacham and Paisek in the Torah world. So as a result, his words were more makubal. But he was a tremendous Baal Chesed. They say that his second wife, he married an almana with 10 children, 10 young children. And he raised the children as if, you know, he was their father. He was metabel with them. He would get up in the middle of the night to change diapers, etc. Mamish, he was already in his 70s when he did all of this, but he held that a Yid has to always be willing to do chesed for everybody. And in fact, he was the one that said that your wife is the most important everybody, right? You do chesed for everybody else, you do chesed for your wife, and especially in almana. He held that it's interesting chiddush lahalacha, that the iser of being mitzara in almana even applies when she remarries. So he says if he married an almana, he says he's not allowed to be mitzara, therefore he's mechoyev to do all sorts of things. So these were some of the personalities of Musar that one should be familiar with. And I have to say, in some ways, Rav Itzel and Rav Naftali may have been a little bit of a corrective to the altar, because the altar was godless Adam. Now godless Adam, al-sad hara, could lead to gaiva. But then you had a Rav Itzel who gave kind of a fiery Musar about shiftless Adam sometimes, and that was kind of the corrective to this. Now, in this connection, I want to mention, again, this is really a travesty that I have to be so short, but there are two people in Chabadka that you need to know that represent transition figures. Remember the story. We have Rav Shimshon Afal Hirsch. And what's going on in Germany? What's going on in Germany is a very, very different process than what went on in Poland, Russia, and the like. Germany was almost totally taken over by the reform movement. It wasn't Haskalah, it was the reform movement. And the reform movement was like a virus, it was like a cancer, that in the span of less than 100 years, from the beginning of the 1800s till 1870s, 90% of the Jews in Germany either converted to Christianity, not that they believed in Christianity, but you know, to get a job, you know, this could either be a Christian, so people would just sign a paper, you know, or they were reformed. In fact, we even have memoirs, imagine this, about a boy writes later, his father was an Orthodox rabbi, and it's hard to even imagine this, and he describes the day that they decided they would be reformed, because you know, it's easier. So he describes his mother taking him to a treif butcher for the first time. And he says he was like 9 years old. And the mother is like shaking. She's quaking. You know, she holds him on like she's walking. You know, she's so afraid that Hashem is going to send a lightning bolt and like destroy them off the face of the earth, Mimela. And they're walking. And he says his mother's voice cracks as she asks for the ham. Can't even say the words, you know. And the boy says, and we all thought for sure the ground was going to open up. But the person became a reform, obviously, the person is writing as a reform Jew. He says, but you know, the ground didn't open up. And eventually we got used to it. But that's what it was. So Rav Hirsch was invited. Now, and it wasn't just a question of reform, but keep in mind that the way it worked in Europe in the 19th century, Jewish kehilos were given taxing authority from the government, and they had the money to open up shuls, open up mikvahs, whatever it was. It had to come through the community council. But the community councils were controlled by Reform Jews. And they would literally not give money. You wanted to open up a shul, it wasn't even shayach. You couldn't do it. You could have it in your house, but there were no schools, there were no mikvahs, there was no money for anything. They would not allow, and the government didn't care. Whatever the Jewish community did, that was their own decision. So Rav Hirsch was invited, the city of Frankfurt. Now, 100 years before, Frankfurt was the city of the Chassam Sofer. Chassam went to Pressburg, but Frankfurt was, it was the city of the Haflah. It was the city of the Pnei Yoshua. One of the great, great kehilos in Europe. And there were literally only 9 or 10 families that were still Shomer Shabbos in Frankfurt. Now Rav Hirsch was a provincial rabbi in the sticks. He actually was in the country of Germany, in the rural areas of Germany. People were still, there were still people from there because they were not cultured enough to get into Reform. And Rav Hirsch had a very comfortable shteller, kind of in Oldenburg, in the rural parts of Germany, in which, he could learn, he could write. Reform was not a big issue. But he was like a Rav HaRashi of a whole Medina. And these 9 or 10 families from Frankfurt invite him to become their Rav. Now, it's a pretty strange situation. Here you have a person, it's like inviting, let's say, the chief rabbi of England to become the Rav of a little shtibel. But Rav Hirsch saw this as a message min hashamayim that he could try to be machzer haTorah liYishna. And he actually took the position with a very small kehila called Kahal Hadas Yeshurun, and over 40 years he built it up to over 1,000 mishpachas. But Rav Hirsch did many, many things. Number one, he reestablished the kehila of Frankfurt, which later became Breuer's in Washington Heights. Number two, he was a role model for what was called Neo-Orthodoxy, in which many other kehilas in Germany were able to establish Torah values, etc. So many, many, the gedolim of Eastern Europe, the gedolim of the yeshiva world, saw Rav Hirsch as an adam gadol mi'ayid, a gain and a tzaddik. But they did disagree with his shita. Rav Hirsch had two interesting shitas. One, actually three interesting shitas. One was controversial. Actually, all of them were controversial, but one is a chumra, one is a kula. The one that he's best known for is the shita that is called Torah im Derech Eretz, in which Rav Hirsch created a derech in his kehila, where the hanhaga of a person who was a yorei in his yorei v'sholim in his avodas Hashem was not to sit and learn full time, but to combine his learning with a parnasa and a secular education. And it was common in Germany for people to have PhDs, to have doctorates, to have university degrees. And yet, but again, don't confuse, it's not the same as modern Orthodox. And people say, oh, modern Orthodox is Rav Hirsch. It's not Emes, because the Rav Hirsch person was extremely machmir in halacha, extremely. The notion that, you'd go mix swimming or mix dancing or be mezalzel a little bit in some halachas, that was totally foreign. In fact, the Chazon Ish didn't know Klor how to make this, because the Chazon Ish in the Emunah Ubitachon, again, a lot of things he's addressing without mentioning them by name. The Chazon Ish says, it's impossible for a person who is not shakua reishai verubai b'tayra to be truly zohir in mitzvahs, because this is what Chazal say, lo ama aretz chasid. But the Chazon Ish had a kasha, which he bevorns. The Chazon Ish had a kasha. Aye, the Torah Derech Eretz people were not necessarily shakua, reishai verubai in learning, but they had tremendous yiras shemayim. So you'll notice the Chazon Ish puts in a little qualification. It's not shayach unless maybe your morgul bialdusai from the time that you're very young, you're taught how you have to keep every halacha b'daikana. You have to read between the lines, but what the Chazon Ish is trying to fa'emfer is, he's trying to give a certain yishuv for Torah im Derech Eretz. So the balabatim there were very, very medayik in mitzvahs kahalacha, kechut ha'sayra. But, so what did the gedolim say about Rav Hirsch's derech? So the gedolim in Poland had a shita that Rav Hirsch was not advocating Torah and Derech Eretz as an ideal. But Rav Hirsch was a Harash Shah. This is the most he could get away with, given the fact that Germany was so secular on one hand, so reform on the other hand. It wouldn't be shayach to emphasize a Torah-only approach in Germany, because then people wouldn't accept it. So mimeila, he gave them something that would bring them to Hashem, even though it wasn't the right derech. That was their uptaich. Now I want
Baruch
you to
Be'er.
Yeah, Baruch Be'er. That was the uptaich of Rabbi Chanan, Baruch Be'er. But I do want you to know that the old Hirschians are very upset with that. They say that's not emes. Rav Hirsch held bi'etzem, that the shleimus of Torah comes when you bring the Torah into the world. He said, that in fact, on a spiritual way, the concept is that when I learn Chayshin Mishpat, it is not a Dover Shalem until I machnis Chayshin Mishpat into my business and the like. And they taina that Rav Hirsch did not hold it was a Hirasha. Rav Hirsch held it was a Lechatzila and not a Bidiyevet. Now you should know that Breuer's Ad HaYom HaZeh, where Breuer's is the successor congregation to Kahal Adas Yeshurin of Frankfurt, right? Breuer's. It's called Breuer's simply because the first Rav after World War II in Western United was Rav Breuer. And a lot of the children and grandchildren of the Breuer people are in Lakewood, Brisk, Mir. They've kind of left that. And some of the Zakenim are a little upset. They say, you know, this is a bit of a, you know, you're a traitor to the cause. So the present Rav, or at least he was Rev Mantel, is he still the Rev? Rev Mantel. So Rev Mantel got up, he's the Rev of the Washington Haskila, and he spoke at a Suda, which was the yard site of Rev Shimshon of Paul Hirsch, and he said, Bizman Hazeh, Torah Derech Eretz is a dead shita. Doesn't work, Bizman Hazeh. So some of these Zakenim, I mean, they could barely walk. they wanted to walk out in protest. They said, "You're mezalzel the whole shita of the Gila." But the emes is, I'll tell you this much: the emes is that you can have a machlokas. Was Rav Hirsch's shita lechatchila then, or b'diyeved then? But even if Rav Hirsch was lechatchila then, he might be maida. It's b'diyeved now. You see, and the reason is because the nisayon of secular education in Rav Hirsch's time was not the same nisayon as today. In Rav Hirsch's time, the nisayon was a philosophical one. It was an intellectual one. A person would learn Kant, a person would learn certain ideas of apikorsis that might affect his emunah. So the question is, can you deal with this? Rav Hirsch held, if a person is strong in Taira, he could deal with intellectual challenges. The issue was not Taira, if a character, university students, I mean, society generally was fairly moral in that way. Women dressed sanua. Today it's a different challenge. You know, it's almost like halvai, a kid on a college campus is going to read Kant. You know, he's not going to read Kant. So they know that's too hard. Today the atmosphere is one of taiva, one of laziness, one of indulgence, one of drugs. That, in other words, it's a totally different Messiah. And Mimela, we probably don't know what Rav Hirsch would say about that. Rav Hirsch kind of looked at universities as a place where people discussed ideas. So Mimela, Rav Hirsch held, if a person has a grounding in Torah, he'll be able to deal with these ideals and incorporate them in his life in a constructive way. He wasn't dealing with a mushchistika society of taiva that we have. So that's why you have to be careful not to compare apples and oranges. The shaila of a college campus today is a different type of shaila. Now that is only one shita. That's the most famous shita of Rav Hirsch, Torahim Derech Eretz. And that we might call a kula vis-a-vis the Torah-only approach. Now, Rav Schwab was an interesting person. Rav Volf also. They had the same trajectory. Rav Schwab grew up in a German home, a Torah im Derech Eretz home, a Hirschian home, a very from home, a home where his parents were extremely medayik in halacha, but the expectation was you go to university and you get a job. But as a bocher, he was sent to Mir, and he was exposed to a whole different olam of Limud HaTorah and Avodah and Mussar. And because of this, Rav Schwab wrote one of his first little books. He wrote a little pamphlet called Elu V'Elu, in which he tries to go over the shitas on both sides. And he eventually became Rav Royer's assistant, and then eventually he became the Rav of the Kehillah himself. He was very connected to the yeshiva world. In other words, he wrote much about the dangers of secular exposure and the like. Now, Rav Volbem is maybe a little more complicated because it's not so Boror. Rav Volbem might even be a Baal Shuvah. We're not entirely sure. But certainly, he was not raised in a yeshiva shaho. But he also found his way to Mir, and he became Mir. So here's the thing I want to just share with you. Rav Schwab represents a person who moves away from Rav Hirsch towards the yeshivish model. Rav Volbe the same. But there were people who moved in the opposite direction. The Sridayesh, a beloved Talmud of the Altar of Slobodka, very, very beloved. He was very close to Rav Itzel Petterberger. He was mashpia, and Rav Itzel was mashpia on him tremendously. But he had certain ideas he wanted to. He was intellectually adventurous and a curious person, a brilliant person. And he went to Germany to get some secular education. But he became very committed. He began to think. He says when he first came to Germany, he said he was mezalzel in the sheet of Tayrim Derech Eretz. He saw it as a pshara. He saw it as a compromise. He saw it as a lack of commitment to the Chashiva Satayra. But he changed. He says he saw this as a lechatchila in which you take everything from the world and you understand the bayre better through it. So the Sridayesh represents the opposite movement of somebody who embraced the Hirshian derech. And that's also true for a person who died tragically young, but all the gedolim say he would have become a unique, unique gadol. This is Rav Avram Eliyahu Kaplan. I don't know if you even heard of him. Baruch Hashem, he has descendants that are alive. He died at the age of 33 years old. But he was in the door of Rav Aaron, Rav Yaakov. He was with them. And they say he perhaps would have been the greatest of all of them. Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky said he would have been the greatest of all of them. He became the head of the seminar of the Rebbe, the Hildesheimer Seminar in Berlin. And he became the head as a very young man. He died a year later. He was replaced by Rabbi Chil Yaakov Weinberg, the three-day age. But Rav Kaplan was unique in many, many ways, because Rav Kaplan not only wanted to combine secular wisdom with Torah, but also Chassidus and Musar and Kabbalah. He wanted to take from like everything and everything and combine it. In fact, he even started writing a new parish on Gemara, which would have combined the academic study of Talmud with Rishayim and Achrayim, with the Lamdisha study. He would have combined the Limudim, and I think he did like two Dafim of Brachas only, but you know, like 100 pages on two Dafim, and he wanted to do it on Gad Shas. And Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky said, now you might say, oh, that's new stuff, that's like Steinsaltz, new. No, Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky said this would have revolutionized the whole Derech of Limud in Klal Yisrael, like Rav Chaim did. It would have been a new Rav Chaim revolution. So, very fascinating that the movement went both ways. There were people who went from Rav Hirsch to the yeshiva world, people who went from the yeshiva world into embracing Torah and Derech Hirsch. But that is what Rav Hirsch's shita number one. But there's another shita Rav Hirsch had, which people don't realize. That is, Rav Hirsch had a shita which in German is called Ostrit. Ostrit means ripping away. Rav Hirsch held, you are not allowed to work in any official capacity with the reform movement, even on matters of common concern. So even if it would be a matter of tzedakah or a matter of security, etc., he says you cannot be part of that Eda. And legally, he went to tremendous efforts to legally get the Orthodox Kehilos established as legally independent entities. Now, this was a big machlokas in Germany. There were many rabbanim in Germany, chashuva rabbanim, who said, fakert, if we work with reform and non-religious on matters of common concern, we could be makar of them, we could build more shuls, we could build more mikvahs, we can have more shiurim. And as a result, and this was a very bitter machlokas, I mean, families were split, people wouldn't talk to each other. And in many kehilas in Germany until the war, World War II, there were actually two rabbis. There was an Ostrich rabbi, Ostrich Rav, and there was what was called a Gemeinde Rav. Gemeinde means the union, which was serve the whole community. Rav Hirsch was very makbid al tischaber l'Russia. I want to point out, interestingly enough, that this was a chumrah of Rav Hirsch, because in Lita, that wasn't emes. If you go to even Brisk, under the Brisker Rav did plenty of stuff. I mean, he didn't allow Zionism, you know. But he did plenty of stuff with non-religious people, whether it was Moz Chitim, collecting stucca, security, fire. The Brisker Rav said, we work with everybody with respect to matters that are not religious in nature. So in Vilna, the same thing. Rav Chaim Eicher was very involved with Chilonim in many things. Obviously, in the state of Israel today, at least if you believe in the Medina, Degel HaTorah sits in the Knesset with all sorts of, you know, kofrim, other types of people. And, you know, we work on environmental laws, tax laws. But Rav Hirsch Mamish had a shita. It was almost a fanatical shita. He will not have any official ischabers. Now, to be makar of an individual Reformed Jew, of course, Rav Hirsch said, we welcome any Jew who comes into the Kehillah. The only rules for membership, you didn't have to be a Shomer Shabbos. You could be an officer only if you were Shomer Shabbos. The only requirement was that you had a bris, and you're not married to a guy. You could be a member of a Kehillah, of his Kehillah, without being a Shomer Shabbos. But you come to him, but there would be no recognition. So this issue that's Nogei Lamaisa even today, if I'm invited to give a shir in a Reformed temple, so if I'm going to talk on a panel that I shouldn't do, because, you know, that's going to create problems, but if I'm the only one, so Rav Hirsch would say, can't do it, you're giving legitimacy. Others might say, for character, this is a way you could reach people, it might be kedai. Yeah.
Meaning we said that college back then was a different setting than today. Wouldn't we say the same thing about Austria?
It might be. In fact,
back then they were militant leaders.
That's correct. In fact, the truth of the matter is, Austria probably came from Rav Hirsch's own experience, because for Kert, he saw that the Reformed community.
Was Geiger his roommate?
Geiger lived with him for a while. Geiger was a big Reform anti-religious person. But Geiger was a Talmud of Rav Hirsch. He lived in Rav Hirsch's house. He was his Talmud for a while. And he loved him, but he turned against him. He turned against him at the end. One final mice about Rav Hirsch.
Wasn't
there a third thing you said? Yes. The third thing is Rav Hirsch was naturae carta in terms of Zionist philosophy, which Rav Hirsch actually believed, based on the Gemara and Ksubas, that the Jewish people are not allowed to have a state until the coming of Mashiach. So it's interesting that people look at Rav Hirsch as modern Orthodox. You know, one of the tenets of modern Orthodoxy is a very, very strong pro-Zionist stance. Rav Hirsch was actually very much against, not against Eretz Yisrael, of course, I mean, not against Eretz Yisrael, not against even living in Eretz Yisrael. Economic aid to the Yishuv, etc. Right, Chav Beit Zion. But he was against any push towards Medina. He said, until the coming of Mashiach, it was ushered. So people think the Torah character are like crazy people, but the MS is, before 1948, there were many, many Zoramim in Chal Yisrael that in fact had that Shita. Even Chabad had that Shita. Although Chabad is like big pro-Zionist, but Chabad, if you go back to the Rebbe Rashab, he said, he quoted the same Gemara, that made a Shvua, you can't have a...
The Gemara
in Ksubah says that at the time of the Churban, HaKadosh Baruch Hu made us swear three things. Lo Yalu B'chaimah, we're not going to try to conquer Eretz Yisrael by force, we're not going to rebel against the Umayyads, and we're not going to try to cause the coming of Mashiach Kabbalistically. Now, one thing, I just want to end with one final thought. Rav Hirsch was very, very worried. He was sick towards the end of his life, and he was worried. He used to get paid 3 months in advance. So he was worried that he would be nifter before he earned his salary for the last quarter. So he told his family, he left at Savoy very meticulously, please, please, please be sure to refund any money for the part of the year that I was not alive for. But a Kaddish Baruch Hu, and this really bothered him a lot. First was Nifter December 31st at 12 midnight. So, so he earned every cent, so nothing had to, and Bukhashan was lucid till the end.
He felt that it's necessary, if you have a lady who's religious and you have a home, he built up, instead of building a school for men first, he built a school for girls first.
Right. Now there are controversies here. There's some proof that boys did not wear yarmulkes during secular Limudei Chol. I mean, there's some interesting things about some of the anhagas he had in the Kehila, and also some people record that he held his, you were allowed to go to operas based on his understanding of Kalisha. So there were certain kulas, but they always came from Yerushalayim. They were not stamazai amego, but he had certain cheshbainas as to what were much. Okay, so Mr. Shem, we will come back to this.
When is the Sharon of Cook?
When is the Sharon of Cook? Well, what do people want? We could arrange something.